Good morning, everyone. I am delighted to be here with all of you. I am grateful for this appointment, and I'm truly humbled by the awesome responsibility that's been entrusted to me by the bishop and his cabinet in appointing me to be your next minister here at Christ Church by the Sea. I have a request, and that is that in the weeks and months ahead, you will keep me in your prayers, since I will need your help and support so that I may be a good and faithful steward of the ministry of this congregation. Thank you very much. Last month, I attended a workshop for all ministers who are moving to a new church. That's where I met Joy Price, your former pastor, who was very gracious and helpful in orienting me to this congregation. At the workshop, the bishop suggested that, by way of introducing ourselves, we might share our vision of the ministry with our new congregations. So, taking up his suggestion, I want to use this opportunity to say something about what I think it means to be a minister. And to do so, I'm going to reflect upon a text written by my namesake in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul. Since Paul addresses this very question of what it means to be a minister in his first letter to the Thessalonians. Hence, this Paul wants to share with you some of what I have learned as a result of my study of that other Paul, whose letters occupy such a large place in our New Testament. After all, this is how we Christians read the Bible. We don't think of it as merely a history book about people who lived a long time ago. We read it rather by finding ourselves in it. Since we believe that the Bible is also about those of us who are living today, and not only about those who lived way back then. When I read the letters of Paul, I'm not only trying to understand that Paul and his historical context about 2,000 years ago, I'm also trying to understand this Paul in my present historical context. And that's why I think dialogue is really the best way to read the Bible. I approach the Bible with my questions, and yet I come to it letting the Bible approach me with its questions. Since this approach to reading the Bible is dialogical, more like a conversation, it's more accurate to say that today I'm not preaching on Paul, I'm preaching the gospel with Paul, in dialogue with him. This Paul wants to ask what that Paul would say if he were standing here today in this pulpit at Christ Church by the Sea. Paul is the first Christian writer of whom we have any knowledge. His letters are the earliest documents found in the New Testament, even earlier than our four Gospels. Moreover, the text on which our sermon is based this morning, 1 Thessalonians, is the earliest of all Paul's letters that we possess. So by going back to 1 Thessalonians, we are going as far back as the literary evidence permits us to the earliest written expression of Christian faith. This is the first piece of Christian literature that we have. Among New Testament writers, it doesn't get any earlier than Paul. And among Paul's writings, it doesn't get any earlier than 1 Thessalonians. This Paul's first sermon to you, then, is based on that Paul's first letter to the Thessalonians. In this letter, Paul is writing to a congregation of Christians he founded in the city of Thessalonica in Macedonia. The congregation was made up of former pagans, that is, polytheists, people who worshipped many gods. Remember that Jesus and all of his original disciples were Jews, and so was Paul. For Jews, polytheism was a false religion. since Judaism teaches that there is only one God, monotheism. And to the extent that the Jews understood themselves as having a mission to non-Jews, or Gentiles, as they're called, it consisted in leading the Gentiles away from their worship of many gods and bringing them to faith in the one God who is the creator of the world and has an absolute claim on all persons, and who, being invisible, cannot be depicted in images or idols. Although Paul was a Jew who abhorred pagan polytheism, he nevertheless reached across the divide, the gulf separating Jews from Gentiles in the ancient world, by himself becoming a missionary to Gentiles. In this letter, he reminds these former pagans, who are now Christian converts, of their conversion. He writes, "You turned to God from idols to serve a living and true God." So we can learn from Paul that whatever else the new Christian faith was all about, it included a robust affirmation of the one God to whom the Jews have always borne witness. Yet, of course, there's more to Christian faith than belief in one God. There's also that which distinguishes Christians from non-Christian Jews. For we Christians believe that Jesus is the one God's anointed emissary, which is why we call him the Messiah, or Christ in Greek. Paul reminds the Thessalonians that in addition to coming to believe in the one God, they have also embraced Jesus as God's authorized messenger, who will act on God's behalf to judge the world for its failure to acknowledge God. Hence, these former pagans not only turned from idols, from fictitious and imaginary gods, to serve the one real God, but also, as Paul says, to wait for his Son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead, Jesus, who delivers us from the wrath to come. In this highly compressed statement, we glimpse the outlines of Paul's understanding of the gospel and what Paul thinks is at stake in the gospel. For him, there's a difference between true and false religion, and it corresponds to the distinction between worship of the one true God and worship of the many false deities. Connected with this belief is the conviction that we human beings have a responsibility as to how we shall conduct our lives in the world. Because of this responsibility, we shall have to answer to God for the quality and character of our lives. That's what Paul is pointing to when he speaks of the wrath to come, or in traditional language, the last judgment. Since human life has an eternal destiny, even death does not allow us to escape from our accountability to God. The good news, which is what gospel means, is that the true, authentic meaning of our lives is disclosed by God's commissioned representative, Jesus, whom Paul calls God's Son. So by preaching the message of Jewish monotheism, along with the distinctively Christian message about Jesus as God's appointed deputy, Paul summoned these former pagans not only to acknowledge the reality of one God who is their creator and ours, but also to accept the distinctive moral responsibility that comes with being human, since we can choose whether to acknowledge the reality of God or to seek vainly to deny and ignore God as though our lives were not finally in God's hands. Thus, the first thing we can learn about Paul is that he was a preacher of the gospel. His first preaching was that of a missionary engaged in evangelism. But now that he has formed a Christian congregation of former pagans for whom he continues to care, his preaching serves to remind them anew of what the gospel is and what it means for them in their everyday affairs, so that he may nurture and guide them in their pursuit of the Christian life. in place of the original preaching appropriate to evangelism, designed to win converts, there is now the preaching of an ongoing congregation that meets regularly as a church for worship, like this church here this morning. The second thing we can say about Paul is that he was a teacher of theology and ethics. He realized that a good preacher of the gospel has to be prepared to be a good teacher of the gospel, because people have questions about the gospel, about what it means, about what it entails for how we are to think and act, and whether the gospel is true. Here I'm thinking not only about the questions of converts or potential converts, but even scoffers as well. A responsible preacher of the gospel has to be ready to answer people's genuine questions about the gospel, and that's what a good teacher is. Paul was fully up to this task, and we see throughout his letters how he answered the various questions put to him by members of his congregations and by his opponents. Indeed, his greatness consists in the fact that he was concerned not only to bring the gospel to people through his preaching, but also to bring intellectual clarity to the gospel through his teaching. Often this teaching takes the form of argument, whether for the sake of instructing converts to think theologically for themselves, or for the sake of polemics against false understandings of the gospel preached by others. So sometimes Paul asks rhetorical questions designed to lead his hearers or readers to come up with the correct answers themselves. So in Romans, for example, he asks, is God the God of the Jews only? Is God not also the God of Gentiles? You see, when Paul states the question in this way, he assumes that the answer is obvious, and we, his readers, will be able to draw the correct conclusion and say, yes, God is the God of Gentiles also, since there is only one God. At other times, Paul is fiercely polemical against what he considers to be distorted interpretations of the gospel. In the letter to the Galatians, he warns his converts against embracing what he decries as a different gospel, preached by those who want to pervert the gospel of Christ. And in 2 Corinthians, he warns against another Jesus than the one we preached. Returning to 1 Thessalonians, Paul writes that he does not want his congregation to be ignorant and uninformed about a particular question they have asked him regarding the fate of those Christians in their midst who have already died. He then goes on to explain that the dead are not lost to God, and he assures them that you do not need to grieve as others do who have no hope, referring to the non-Christian pagans who believe that death is the ultimate annihilation of human life. So teaching plays an essential role in Paul's ministry, and what he teaches is of direct existential and pastoral concern to those in his congregation as they seek to understand and to live their lives in the light of a correct and sound grasp of the gospel. So after instructing them on how they should think about death, Paul can say to them, comfort one another with these words. Although his former pagan converts embraced the gospel as a message that dramatically changed their lives, this didn't mean that they no longer had any questions about the gospel, or that there weren't things they were confused about. You see, it's one thing to be able to proclaim the gospel rhetorically and persuasively. It's another thing to be able to interpret it intelligently, so as to answer the questions that both Christians and non-Christians have. Paul was no anti-intellectual Christian, as so many Christians today are. Indeed, every reader of Paul's letters has to be impressed with the caliber of his intellect and with his firm resolve to put his intellect to full use in the service of the gospel. Paul, the teacher, wanted his congregations to understand the gospel they had embraced when they heard Paul the preacher. Preaching and teaching are thus a unity, and they belong together in Paul's understanding of his ministerial responsibility. The third thing we can say about Paul is that Paul was a pastor. He nurtured his congregations, and he was concerned for each individual member in them. He cared about the people under his charge, and he sought their well-being. In his role as a pastor, Paul likened himself to a father and to a nursemaid. He supported them in their endeavor to live an authentically Christian life, and so he wrote, "Like a father with his children, we exhorted and encouraged each one of you to lead a life worthy of God." He was considerate of them. He wrote, "We were gentle among you, like a nurse taking care of her children." Paul realized that responsible pastoral care can only be undertaken by persons of real moral integrity. So he reminds the Thessalonians that his ministry among them was motivated neither by greed nor by aspirations for glory, and that he never engaged in deceit or flattery. He described his own conduct as blameless, saying that he did not want to burden any of them. In an especially lovely remark, he writes, "Being affectionately desirous of you, we were ready to share with you not only the gospel, but our very own selves, because you had become dear to us." In another letter, he makes the same point about giving himself to others even more poignantly. "I will not be a burden, for I seek not what is yours, but you. I seek not what is yours, but you. I will gladly spend and be spent for your souls." Paul the pastor does not ask anything of his congregation except that they share themselves with him and let him share himself with them. As a result of my dialogue with that Paul, this Paul has learned that a minister is a preacher, a teacher, and a pastor. Like that other Paul, this Paul intends to proclaim the gospel to you who are members of this congregation, as well as to those who are not members of this congregation. To those of you who have already embraced the gospel and who come here every Sunday to hear it anew and afresh, I promise to take my responsibility as your preacher with complete seriousness, always being prepared to make the texts of the Bible come alive through serious dialogue with them. To those who are non-Christians because they've never really heard the gospel as good news, I will seek to be an evangelist, announcing the glad tidings of God's love for all people. To those who are seeking meaning in life but despair of ever finding it, I will try to be Christ's ambassador, delivering the message that life's authentic meaning is not an achievement to be sought after, since it's a free gift from God to be received with open hands. Like that other Paul, this Paul will be a teacher of theology and ethics, seeking to bring intellectual clarity to the gospel in a time when there is much confusion about it, both within the churches and outside of them. If I have to be polemical at times when confronting distortions of the gospel, so be it. Like the Apostle Paul, I will defend the genuine article against those who preach a different gospel or another Jesus. To those who are sincerely asking questions, I will assist them to gain clarity about what confuses them. To those who want to learn more about the Bible and the church's tradition, I will be a resource enabling them to develop their own theological and ethical thinking in conversation with these classical sources. To those who have doubts, they will have my complete attention, and my thinking will be engaged as we ponder together the difficult existential questions in an open spirit of truthfulness. And finally, like that other Paul, this Paul will seek to be a compassionate and gentle pastor, caring for the precious souls in this congregation with love and tenderness. I want everyone in this congregation to know that my door is always open to you when the challenges of your life have you weighed down and discouraged, or when the circumstances of your lives are causing you grief and heartache. By the same token, I want to celebrate your joys and triumphs also. Like the apostle, I believe that a pastor has to be a person of moral integrity, whom others can trust and respect, so that no one ever has to fear being deceived or manipulated or abused. As that Paul said to the Thessalonians, so I say to you, I want to share with you not only the preaching and teaching of the gospel, but also my very self. And I hope that you will also share yourselves with me as we walk together on this road of life as Christians who seek to be faithful to God in the face of all the ups and downs of being human. Like that other Paul, I don't want what is yours. I want you. In short, for both that Paul and this Paul, being a minister requires great faith to preach, great intelligence to teach, and great love to pastor. Great faith, great intelligence, and great love, of course, are ideals, and we don't always live up to our own ideals. But it is important nonetheless to be clear as to what our ideals are so that we can direct our lives in accordance with them. I hope that my ministry among you will be characterized by these ideals: great faith, great intelligence, and great love. When I met Joy Price at the bishop's workshop, she was glad to be able to report that this is a vital congregation. And I could sense this myself when I was introduced to the members of the leadership team by the district superintendent. Their love for this congregation was palpable, and their welcome of me was warm and genuine. In these respects, too, I am reminded of that other Paul's experience among the Thessalonians. He writes to them about the good reputation they have gained for themselves in other Christian congregations. He wrote, "You became an example to all the believers in Macedonia, and your faith in God has become known to them all." Even the friendly news of his reception by the Thessalonians was circulating in these other churches. They themselves report what a welcome we had among you. So, my friends, we can be grateful for the faith, intelligence, and love of the leaders and members of this congregation, both past and present. We can be thankful that God has entrusted us with the ministry of the gospel in this place and time. And so, looking with hope and confidence to the future, let us commit ourselves anew to the ministry of this congregation, praying that our faith, intelligence, and love may be increased evermore, so that as servants of God, we might be of service to all of God's people, as was Jesus himself. For that is what the words minister and ministry mean: servant and service. Of his own ministry, Jesus said, "I came not to be served, but to serve." Amen.